Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight to the Sydney Institute, and thanks to King and Wood Mellisons for the use of this fine and renovated now facility. Gladys Berejiklian makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. She first spoke here when she was head of the Young Liberals in New South Wales a couple of decades ago now, but she's better known for...
younger than that, Jerry.
We must have been the very Young Liberals, yeah. Now, of course, Gladys Berejiklian is very well known for many things. Her background was in business with the Commonwealth Bank. She became the MLA for Willoughby in 2003, had various roles in the Shadow Ministry. After the election of the Liberal National Party government in New South Wales, Gladys Berejiklian became the Minister for Transport, and after the last election, the Treasurer. And it's in that capacity that she's addressing the Sydney Institute tonight on the topic of modern government, less can be more. The Minister, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Good evening, everybody. To Gerard and ladies and gentlemen, it is always an honour to address the Sydney Institute, as this is a unique forum where elected representatives such as myself are able to flesh out the vision behind our decision-making. And this evening, as Gerard has outlined, I want to argue the case for smaller governments, governments that are more efficient and maintain their focus on their core business. The greatest challenge facing governments is that resources are limited. This makes it impossible to meet each and every one of the community's demands and expectations, even though we would like to. Therefore, governments need to be efficient, innovative and flexible to ensure the very best outcomes for our citizens. I will argue that in the era of ever-advancing technological development, less can be more. Governments can and should work smarter to maximise community benefits and return on every dollar that we spend. And I want to say very clearly, this is not code for reducing the services or infrastructure that governments provide or generate. Quite the contrary. I will argue that it is an opportunity for governments to generate more services and more infrastructure from the limited resources that we have. To provide context for this discussion, we need to consider the purpose and core business of government in the modern era. We must constantly ask ourselves, why do governments exist? As many of you would recall, well, or read about, in 1776, Adam Smith, regarded as the father of modern economics, wrote about what he saw as the three legitimate functions of government: the defence of the nation, the administration and enforcement of legal rights, and the delivery of certain public works and institutions. 2.5 centuries on, and the importance of these functions remain paramount. The question for modern governments becomes one of scope and method. Where do the responsibilities of government start and end, and how should government exercise its functions? To answer this, I refer to John Stuart Mill's view of liberalism, that governments should allow individuals to live freely as long as they do not impinge on the freedom of others, and that governments should provide a quality of opportunity for individuals and communities to be their best. I believe that Smith's basic but important scope, coupled with Mill's view on equality of opportunity and individual rights, provides a sound context for determining the role of a modern government. Within this framework, I want to outline what I believe are three principles of modern government. These are: 1, regulating with a light touch. Governments should regulate without fitting the work of Smith's invisible hand. 2, governments should ensure the delivery of services and infrastructure. Government should be agnostic as to who provides a service within the operating environment they regulate, while still supporting growth in those markets. In the delivery of infrastructure, we should adopt global best practice using varied funding models and sources, and never adopt a one-size-fits-all approach. 3, enabling and growing opportunity. Governments should be as efficient as possible so that resources can be dedicated to supporting the infrastructure and service requirements of the community and to boosting economic growth. This ensures that governments can also allocate resources compassionately to ensure that every citizen maintains the right of equality of opportunity. Allow me now to expand on these points and demonstrate that at the core of each of the concepts is that less can be more, that smaller government is in fact big government. First, regulating the light touch. Governments should be as small as possible to ensure innovation can flourish and not be thwarted by onerous regulatory regimes. Governments should regulate and generate growth, but in the modern era, regulation definitely needs to be light touch. This allows for nimbleness and flexibility when coping with rapidly advancing technology in an ever-changing environment. To use a recent example, the entry of Uber has caused government to shift the regulatory environment of point-to-point transport services. If governments are serious about driving innovation, they must ensure there are no competitive disadvantage for any new entrants in a given market. Future regulation needs to consider flexible systems to allow for the adoption and entry of new technologies and industries that may not even exist yet. For instance, the Opal electronic ticketing system is an open system, which means one day it could be scaled up to allow customers to use credit cards or mobile phones. Driverless cars are another example. Clearly, governments could not have anticipated when drafting the road rules that one day it would be safe for people to travel around at high speed in a car without a driver. Yet we might find in a few years' time that travelling in a driverless car is actually safer as it eliminates the risk of human error. As governments, we need to be nimble in making sure we enhance, not inhibit, and embrace technological change. The need to be nimble and flexible brings me to my next example of reform we are undertaking in financial management across government. The financial management transformation, or I'll use the acronym FMT, will deliver a world-class financial management framework for New South Wales. It involves a change in the structure of the budget and financial practices across the New South Wales public sector. This will eventually allow monitoring of the state's financial position in real time. Transformation of government financial practices is long overdue. Yeah. Thank you. Currently, financial modelling, forecasting and analysis are captured in IT systems that are some 20 years old, and this is clearly inefficient. Having cleaner, clearer information at our fingertips will enable government to make the best use of public resources in a sustainable way. The FMT program will also provide greater insights into the results being delivered by government, not just the expenses of the government, but also balance sheet management. We are working hard to have Treasury's new IT system ready in time for the 2017-2018 budget. The second point, ensuring the delivery of services and infrastructure. Governments, I believe, should be agnostic as to who provides a service within a regulated environment. Citizens are increasingly placing a high value on the quality of service they receive and are becoming less concerned about the source of the service. Government will always regulate the provision of the core service, but the service provider should be the entity that can provide the best quality and the best value for money. In some instances, this may be government or the community sector. Increasingly, it will be the private sector. To put it simply, if the private or non-government sector can do something better, then government needs to step back. A good example of this concept is the franchising of Sydney Ferries, which has resulted in services that are more frequent and higher quality. Government continues to regulate the service through fares and route selection, and it is unlikely that passengers care on a day-to-day basis the actual provider or service provider is a private company. Customers are happier, the taxpayer is protected through provision of a fixed contract, which costs less than the public sector comparator, and the private sector gets involved in a public activity from which it was previously excluded. Another innovative way we are involving the private and non-government sectors is service delivery through social impact investment. Very proudly, the New South Wales government is the first government in Australia to implement social benefit bonds. This concept is about generating positive outcomes for the community alongside financial return for investors and for government. Social impact investments bring together capital and expertise from the public, private and not-for-profit sectors to tackle a range of social issues, a great example of collaboration. By harnessing the innovation and capital of the non-government sectors, we can deliver better outcomes for the most vulnerable people in our communities. This is a big shift from how governments traditionally fund services, and we can be sure that taxpayers' money is put towards programs that make a positive and meaningful difference to people's lives. And I want to outline the example or the case study of the NewPIN program, which is a great case study in social impact investment. The NewPIN program aims to restore children in out-of-home care to their families, and the results to date have been amazing. The NGO running the support service has had a success rate of 65% in restoring families. This compares to about 25% of the success rate of governments. Private sector investors have received returns of 7.5% and 8.9% in the first 2 years of the program. As well as this, taxpayers got a better deal as less was spent to achieve a greater outcome, higher success rates for less dollars spent. Most importantly, government was able to better support those most vulnerable in our community. We've committed to two new areas of social impact investment every year, and the opportunities are endless. This is opening up the frontier in areas which were previously regarded as the sole domain of government. The digital age, as we know, also provides enormous opportunities for innovative service delivery, as well as smaller, more effective government. You can already experience how the New South Wales government is embracing technology simply by walking into any Service New South Wales centre. Service New South Wales is an excellent example of how cutting-edge technology can be used to deliver better services while making the taxpayer dollar go further. Customers have a one-stop shop where they can conduct more than 800 different types of transactions. Taxpayers get a better deal with huge savings made in back-office processing, and by 2019, the New South Wales government wants to see 70% of all transactions conducted digitally. Now to infrastructure delivery, where the aim should always be global best practice and never a one-size-fits-all approach. To illustrate this, I'll use the examples of the North West Metro or the North West Rail Link, the Northern Beaches Hospital and WestConnex, three very different projects with three very non-traditional funding models. The North West Metro is comprised of three major contracts, the first two being traditional design and construct contracts, and the third being the operations, train and rail systems contract, which was procured as a public-private partnership with an availability payment mechanism. The successful tenderer, MTR, which runs the Hong Kong Metro network, will operate the new line, which incidentally will have driverless trains, a first for Australia. The government sets the fares and makes payments to the private sector, which takes risk on the operational performance. Similarly, innovative is the WestConnex finance strategy, which involves a mix of public and private finance. For the initial WestConnex stages, state equity is co-investing alongside private debt. The state's equity investment in these initial stages will be sold and recycled to fund investment in the latter WestConnex stages. Incidentally, the North West Metro is Australia's largest public transport project and the WestConnex is Australia's largest rail project. For the Northern Beaches Hospital, the state has employed an operator-led delivery model. The operator is responsible for building and operating the facility and will receive ongoing performance-based payments. This unique funding model reduces the upfront capital burden on the state, with a total state capital contribution of approximately $360 million for the $600 million facility. These three examples demonstrate that governments need to be flexible when it comes to funding essential infrastructure the community desperately needs. In New South Wales, record spending in infrastructure is occurring not only because we've been open to new and emerging funding models, but also because asset recycling has freed up billions in upfront capital to reinvest in productive infrastructure. While understandably, so much focus of the government's economic management is on the general government sector, that is the state budget, which is in the order of $70 billion a year, the state's total sector balance sheet is in the order of $300 billion. We believe there are big opportunities to better manage this. And the third and last principle I want to outline is government enabling and growing opportunity. Governments should be as small and as efficient as possible to ensure resources are dedicated where they are needed most. This allows for governments to focus on their core business and do that well, rather than venture areas into areas best left to others. A case in point is job creation. Good governments focus on stimulating the economy to grow jobs, not just on growing the public service. To use an example from my former portfolio, one of my priorities was reforming the bureaucracy which delivers transport in New South Wales. When we came to government, there were 10 disparate, silent transport agencies that were all doing their own separate planning and policy work. This was reduced to one main agency responsible for planning and policy functions in the state, which could deliver instructions to those delivery agencies. This meant the operators could focus on their core business of providing world-class transport services. When I left the transport portfolio, there were 2,000 fewer back office staff in Sydney Trains and New South Wales Trains than there were in Rathport when I arrived. At the same time, very proudly, there were well over 1,100 extra services and customer satisfaction had increased. It is not necessary to grow the public service in order to stimulate employment growth. I am proud that New South Wales is creating more than half the jobs in the nation and has done so for more than a year. And we haven't done this by growing the public service, far from it. We've achieved this through economic growth, stimulating both business and consumer confidence, and taking advantage of the opportunities the diverse economy, such as ours in New South Wales, has during a commodities market downturn. No doubt growth in the housing market and our infrastructure spend are part of this story. But there is still more to do in increasing efficiency and reducing duplication across government. You may be surprised to learn, as I was, that currently there are about 870 New South Wales government entities, including departments, agencies, state-owned corporation boards, committees and trusts. I know this because I recently asked an expert panel to audit the structures within our government and present recommendations on how our processes can be leaner and more efficient. Many of these identified bodies overlap in terms of the functions they perform. There is opportunity here to reduce this number, not for the sake of it, but because it will reduce waste, streamline decision-making, and make government work better. To give you an example of some of these bodies, there are 76 separate Crown Land Trusts managing assets on behalf of local communities. One of them manages a tennis court in Newcastle, another manages a small historic pumping station near Maitland. While the government is yet to decide this exact course of action, the panel has recommended that these should not be separate trusts and should be merged into one. Over decades, these bodies may have been established for a specific purpose, which no longer exists or is no longer regarded as important. Yet they have remained as part of the machinery of government, either because they were established without sunset clauses or they were simply overlooked, something we will rectify for new bodies established into the future. The intention of this reform is to streamline administration and governance arrangements and consolidate government agencies, bodies, boards and committees. This process could deliver significant savings, which could be poured back into essential services. But this is more than just about simply saving money. It is about improving the delivery of services and infrastructure to the people of New South Wales by reducing regulatory burdens and strengthening lines of accountability. And it is about ensuring that government focuses on its core business. In conclusion, In New South Wales, our government has come a long way in getting back to the core business of good government and focusing our energies and resources on what is most important. By managing our resources better, we have generated economic growth, supported the most vulnerable, and worked collaboratively with the community and private sector to make this happen. Much reform has been achieved, but there is much more to come. We will continue to be an enabler for economic growth, a good and responsible regulator, and a compassionate and efficient provider of quality services and infrastructure. I hope that tonight I've effectively illustrated to you that when it comes to modern government, less can be more. Governments are nothing if they do not protect, deliver and build. It is not the size of government that determines success in achieving these noble objectives, but the way government collaborates and operates. Thank you for your time this evening.
Many thanks to the Minister. Thanks also to King and Wood Mellisons for the use of this fine facility. As I said, we'll come to questions and discussion. Questions should be on the topic, broadly defined. As I said, we take questions from our members and their guests here today. And we have plenty of time. Now, that was a lively title, Less Can Be More. But from listening to you, I think in a sense... it's probably also more can be less, because what you said, for example, when you came in as transport, is that I think what were 2,000 jobs in what was then Rail Corps disappeared, and they were replaced by 1,000 increased services. So the question is, as you look at all these other bodies, and as you know, this problem in New South Wales, and less probably now than in other states, goes back a long time. I mean, what do you think those 2,000 people were doing in Rail Corp now that they're gone and the trains still run? What was going on there?
I don't want to go too much over old ground, Jared, and I could talk for hours on that topic. But the point I want to make strongly is, and I want to stress this point, that since we've been in government, we've created more than 300,000 jobs in New South Wales. And that's not public service jobs. It's been jobs in the community, supporting business, supporting economic growth. And similarly, in the last 12 months, we've created consistently more than half the jobs in the entire nation. So if you put all the other states together, we're still creating more jobs than every other state combined. And I want to make that point at the outset, because for us and for any government, job creation is so critical. But it's where you create those jobs. Are they sustainable? Are they productive? And how is it going to help the community and the economy? So my point is that when it comes to the public service, we need to be as efficient as possible. We need to always look at ourselves and say, how can we manage ourselves better? And how can we use our energies into supporting those most vulnerable, supporting our core services, but also supporting that economic growth in the wider community? So when I looked at that piece of work, and it was a huge piece of work, we found that a lot of functions were no longer necessary. Governments tend not to like to change things a lot. But when I looked at some of the functions that were occurring, some processes had been outdated decades earlier through technology or other means. So it was about how do you do it in a compassionate way, but how do you do it that's going to help the community? And the question that I always asked myself when I was making a tough decision was, is this decision going to have an overwhelming positive impact on the community? And ironically, sometimes when you have too many people doing a job, the job doesn't get done. And it's about making sure government was using its resources most effectively. And the fact that we actually spent less providing the service but provided 1,100 more services is a good indictment or a good example of less can be more. And that's what we're building upon into the future.
Thanks. So there's a question here. Don't stand in front of the camera. Yeah. Just go. We'll pick you up. Yep. Yeah, go on. Don't stand in front of the camera.
Oh. You mentioned digitisation. As the Constitution allows you as Treasurer to issue digital debit cards to finance infrastructure, why do you employ taxes and go into debt?
Well, the good news is, because of our asset recycling strategy, in the general government sector, we're essentially, which never ever happens, we're actually find ourselves in an ideal position where we actually don't have debt in the general government sector. So because of our asset, now that will change because of our asset recycling policy.
But we still have tax.
Okay.
So my point is that if you take some tough decisions, and full credit to our Premier Mike Baird for taking that courageous decision before the election on Polls and Wise, that asset recycling strategy has unlocked an extra $20 billion we'll have in infrastructure moving forward. So if you make those decisions, you're able to free up billions of dollars you can invest in infrastructure, which then the community owns. So you're actually transferring one asset into more productive infrastructure, and we're really excited by what that means for our state. The regions get about $6 billion, the rest of the state gets the balance, and we're able to build that infrastructure which has been lacking and longing for so many decades.
Question here.
Minister, I think you've done more than streamline the services. You have also changed the culture. I frequently catch your country link trains, and I go into service first, and people smile at me. They say, how can I help you? And this is a profound difference. How difficult was that for you?
Question about changing the culture.
Yeah, I think the key thing to know that as a government, you're a service provider no different to anyone else in the community. And so for every decision we take, and I know that each of my ministerial colleagues abide by this, is that the customer has to be at the centre of every decision you take. So whether it's providing a transport service or a hospital bed or an education, we need to make sure we're the best provider of service available. And if we're not, we need to make sure the best provider of service is being engaged to do that. And I think customer centricity or client centricity is something our government has brought in terms of cultural change, which is so important. So every time I make a decision, I say, how is this helping the citizen? How is this helping the customer? How is this helping the person acquiring the government service? Because that's really what it's about. It's about quality services, not just making people feel they'll just lump it or leave it. It's about giving people good choice, value for money as taxpayers, but also value for money as customers. And that cultural shift, I think, is throughout our government. And we started that from day one. And I think that really also builds confidence that when you are making some tough decisions, that at the end of the day, you've got the public's interests first and foremost in your mind. And the fact that you save money along the way is a bonus. But I often find that when you think about how can I best provide this service, you have to be forced into thinking, well, how can I make myself more efficient in providing a better service? And that ultimately leads you to good decision making, which as a bonus happens to save money in the back office and frees up money to spend on the front line, which is where people want it.
Yes, I think you're doing a marvellous job.
Thank you.
Mike Beard too. I was very impressed by what you said. I think it was a PIN project.
The new PIN, yeah, I'm very proud of that.
Unification.
Yeah.
And also by the what you were saying about Polls and Wires, that there was a shift of public assets from one form to another form and so on. But I don't get that message through from the media.
There's a few of them here tonight, so I'll let you address the question.
How can you do more to somehow publicise these, what I think are very, very substantial achievements?
Yeah. I think at the end of the day, customers or our citizens speak with their feet. So the new PIN project you alluded to is something we're very proud of as a government. And again, commending Mike Baird, who started the concept of social impact investment when he was the Treasurer, and also our Ministers for Family and Community Services that allowed that to happen. But that is a great case study and example of government working with the non-government or community sector and with private investors to get a better outcome. And I think people would be shocked to know that, unfortunately, in New South Wales, there are between 19,000 and 20,000 children that don't live with their families for one reason or another. Now, this is a huge social challenge. And if we can get the non-government and private sector help government deal with that social challenge, an area previously in the sole domain of government, if we can actually have a collaborative approach, it's obviously better for the families involved, better for the taxpayer, because we're actually getting better outcomes for what we're investing, and better for NGOs who feel empowered because they've got that professional support from private investors, but also from government, who provides the framework. So that gives us enormous potential into the future, because there were certain areas which were solely the domain of government, and we're saying let's think outside the box, because what we want is, in this case study, to help kids reunite with their families and to keep them with their families, not to just have it as a transition. And then you get, you know, a huge boost for the most vulnerable in the community, whilst the taxpayer gets a better outcome, and of course the private investors get a return. And as an aside, I said to one of the private investors once, "You must feel really great contributing to such a noble cause." And they said, "No, we just like to make the money." Now that was perhaps a crass response, but what it demonstrates is that every different part of the puzzle felt that they were getting something out of the process. But what was most important to us, and something I believe in very strongly, was the social outcome. Actually using less, but getting a much, much better outcome for those most vulnerable.
Now, hang on, we've got to move on.
Yeah, I've said enough, so hopefully they've got the message, but thank you for the question.
Now, you've got to talk right in, if anyone asks you a question, you've got to talk right into the microphone, right?
Thank you very much, Minister. I noticed that a lot of young voters are not very familiar with the way government works. And if they were here tonight, they wouldn't be familiar with so much of what you talked about. Are there ways, you think, of improving the education so that people know more about civil society and about the workings of government?
Suggesting that young voters don't know much about how government works.
I actually feel the digital age has made people much more engaged with what government is doing. So I would differ from your opinion. I actually think young people are much more engaged and have the ability to influence much more than they used to. And there's no doubt that as elected representatives, it's always in our interest to do what we can to provide information to all sections of the community, especially young people, because I believe very much it's in our interest. If you want to reduce cynicism in something, you increase involvement, increase information, and make people feel empowered. And so my very strong message to young people, regrettably I'm no longer in that category, is my very strong message to young people is you can make a huge difference, much more than 20 or 30 years ago. I think the social and digital age has really allowed people to be more involved and to feel more empowered to affect change. And I think that is a very positive outcome, not only because it helps drive good decision-making, but also because people feel empowered. If you feel empowered and part of something, you're more likely to be constructive, and I think that's a great positive.
Question. You've got to speak into the microphone.
Hi. So, question from a young person, but not a specifically young person issue. So I was very, very impressed to hear about the talk of efficiency, you know, doing more with less. Something I'm hopeful for is that the state government will take a similar attitude to the revenue side as well. And in particular, the tax white paper identified stamp duty as essentially one of the most inefficient, most distortionary of all the taxes. The Henry Tax Review made a similar observation and recommended abolishing stamp duty in favour of more broad-based land tax. I was interested in what your thoughts are in terms of doing something to improve efficiency on the revenue side.
You know, as a state government, it's never fun to have to tax people on stamp duty or land tax or payroll tax. And obviously the topic of tax reform is extremely topical at the moment, given our interactions with the federal government. So we're confident of ongoing discussions which will lead to whole-scale reform. And once we know more definitively what the federal picture is, we will obviously look at our own system. But one important piece of tax reform that we did recently doesn't impact revenue, but it's an important principle, is around the emergency services levy. So previously, emergency services in New South Wales were largely funded through insurance premiums, which meant that New South Wales had some of the highest rates of underinsurance and non-insurance. So we've actually now announced major reform in that area. We're the last mainland state to make that reform, but that reform will now mean people will pay through a levy on property as opposed to through their premiums. So that is an example of where state governments can make good reform. It doesn't impact our revenue position, but at least it allows us to keep our pedal on the metal in terms of being reformist. And we are more than happy to look at the overall tax position. In fact, the Premier, myself and our government have made some constructive suggestions to the federal government on what we think will work into the future. We're confident of those ongoing discussions. And we are up for reform. But for us as states, 40% of our revenue, for those of you who may not realise, 40% of our state budget comes from the federal government in one form or another. So what happens at that level is really contingent on what we're able to do at our level. But thank you for the question.
Thank you, Minister. You've raised some really interesting case studies of public-private partnerships and the benefits. Could you perhaps speak to the governance side a little bit? Because I'm something I'm not particularly familiar with, but who sets the targets? How are they measured? What is the audit process, given that, you know, using the new PIN example, we've got a fairly major Royal Commission going on in Australia where perhaps that wasn't done quite right in the past. How do we make sure we don't have any nasty surprises down the track?
No, excellent question. And without patting ourselves on the back too much, I think one thing we did well as a government nearly 5 years ago when we were elected is actually set up important governance frameworks and accountability. And I think the public and community always needs confidence that when there's a major project or a major framework or a major program, that there's good governance and accountability around that. So I can assure you that whether it's a major infrastructure project or a major program, the government has been extremely robust in setting up independent boards, setting up assurance processes. In the infrastructure space, we have a body called Infrastructure New South Wales, which also provides what we call an assurance role. So Infrastructure New South Wales gives government advice on what projects should be priorities, and then that has an important role in assuring the projects are delivered on time and on budget, as does the New South Wales Treasury, of course. But in addition to that, you have the checks and balances of the Auditor-General, of obviously the formal audit process that exists, and we also, in the state-owned corporation space, make sure that we have independent boards who also provide decision-making arm's length from government. And in the case of new and innovative funding models we might have, which might involve private sector interaction with government, in that case, those type of bodies would have to adhere to public governing body requirements, such as those that exist under ASIC and other bodies. So each project is different in its governance, but I can assure you, as someone who oversaw the establishment of a number of major projects in my previous role and now looks at the entire balance sheet, we have very stringent governance requirements around each of these entities. And not only that, but we also make sure that we have really good project managers and project deliverers in addition to those formal governance structures. But for us, it's making sure that the boards that we put together comprise of individuals who have the expertise and the non-government worldview of things to give government advice, because we've got our departments, we've got our agencies that provide us advice. But it's also, if we want to make New South Wales the best place to live and work, we need to get best practice globally. And that's the attitude we have. And that's why we try to be as strict as possible in our governance arrangements, but also involve the best brains in Australia to help us achieve those things.
Minister, the bond yield on New South Wales government treasuries at the moment is about 3%. Bond markets around the world are swamped with people wanting to invest in good governments like yourselves.
But there aren't as many as good as ours.
Exactly. How confident are you that the taxpayers are getting a better deal by private-public partnerships, where the private investors are typically targeting 7 to 10% returns rather than borrowing from the bond markets at, say, 3%?
Yeah, for us, obviously the cost of the project is as important as the quality of the project and the service being provided. So the way that we're doing PPPs, for us, first and foremost, is what are we trying to build, or what service are we delivering, and who is best placed to help us do that. So depending on the project or the service, you'll often find as a government that we're keeping the private sector accountable in terms of their performance during the operational life of that asset. And so the main objective for us is to look at the public sector comparative. If government built this project and operated it, what would it cost? And what would it cost if the private sector did it? And then you overlay that with the quality of the service and the accountability. And when you make that comparison and make it robust, you look at who's providing the better opportunity and you go with that one. And there are certainly circumstances that I faced in my ministerial career when I've actually insourced. if I feel the market's not living up to the community's expectations, there's been decisions I've made when I've actually insourced the service back to government. So it's not about having a philosophical position which says you must always outsource or you must always use a non-government or private sector. It's about saying who is best placed to oversee the process, to fund or deliver the service. And that's the question you need to ask, rather than feeling any level of emotions to who that person or what that entity might be.
Nessie, you've mentioned some very big infrastructure projects. I wonder, does the New South Wales government have a view about the construction of the inland rail from Brisbane to Melbourne? And if they do, whether you have a funding model in mind?
The question whether the minister's up for the inland rail from Brisbane to Melbourne.
Yeah.
Right? Bypassing Sydney.
Yeah. I would certainly have a more detailed response in my previous job, and I'll leave that to Minister Constance to answer. But essentially, any major project which crosses state borders, I believe, has to have the involvement of the federal government as well. So as a state, we've always said we're more than happy to be cooperative, more than happy to be cooperative and collaborative on those major projects. And I think Australia, we need to be up for considering what our communities might look like and what our needs are into the future. So New South Wales, generally speaking, is always up for those discussions of those large-scale projects. But obviously anything that crosses borders has to have the involvement of the federal government as well.
Ross.
Hey, Ross, I didn't see you there. Yes,
I see you. Absolutely delighted to hear a minister making the case for smaller government. We wish there was more of it. But I just want to ask you on a difficult question, which is that according to the OECD's PISA study of educational outcomes in literacy, numeracy, problem solving, Australian students generally are falling further behind the competitors over the last 10 years. And we're now, I think, 3 years behind Shanghai in terms of the average 15-year-old's capacity for literacy and numeracy and problem solving. And I think there is a growing sense in the community that in this core bread and butter issue, especially in the public education system, but not exclusively, and especially in the non-selective government sector, that the architecture of the educational delivery platform is just not producing the outcomes that's going to equip Australians to compete in the generation ahead. And my question is to you as sort of as treasurer. The evidence suggests above about $10,000 per student, more money doesn't help. But the way in which you deliver the system is what matters. And in particular, I wanted to ask you, could our schools become more responsive to parents and students if the parents were, in effect, the funder, whether through some kind of coupon scheme, rather than the school leadership looking exclusively to you and to the Department of Education as their cash cow?
Can I start my answer by saying I'm a product of the public education system, and for me personally and for the government, education is an absolutely core service governments must provide, and I'm proud to oversee a process where it's not all about the dollars, but we are spending literally record amounts in education, because I believe very strongly that if you adhere to the philosophy of making sure that every individual should have an equal opportunity to be their best, that means every child in this state, no matter where they're born, what their circumstances, should expect to get a world-class education system. So I want to say straight up that as a government we believe very strongly in that objective, and we believe the current way that we have funded our schools is the best way forward. But in addition to record amounts spending in education, we're also spending record amounts in vocational education and training, but having much more private sector involvement in that. So if young people from the age of 16 onwards are thinking about not going to university but doing a trade or going into the workforce, we're making sure that we've got the resources and the competition there to allow young people to have the skills they need to get those jobs of the future, jobs that haven't even been... It may not even be in existence today. I mean, the digital age is moving so rapidly that as a state, I must be a smart state where we make sure that every child, every young person has the opportunity to be their best, and you do that through a great education system so that those who attend a public system have equal opportunity as those that attend the private system. And I can't see us going to the more you're proposing, Ross.
So we're getting towards the end. We've got one, two, and then Mr. Pascoe down the back. I think that's about it. Yeah, here. Speak up. You've got to speak up.
Given that the rates in amalgamated councils in Queensland and Victoria are at least 20% per capita more than New South Wales and are growing faster than New South Wales since they were amalgamated, why did the government go for the divisive amalgamation model, which produces productivity of only 1%, rather than for the innovative joint organisation models proposed by people like Professor Allen, which, and challenge the council
okay.
to get a 10% productivity improvement.
Okay, right.
It's a good question. The bottom line is my topic for today's discussion is relevant because I believe less is more when it comes to governments. And as a state government, imagine having to deal with 150 other governments when you're trying to roll out an education initiative or a health initiative or a transport initiative. There is no doubt we have too many councils at the moment, which is why the government's embarked on our amalgamation process. In relation to rates, we've said that no one will pay more for 4 years, so rates will be freezed at the current level, whatever you pay for 4 years. So we are a government that talks the talk, but also acts on our beliefs, and we have simply too many local councils, and it's dysfunctional. And I believe that the process we've adopted and the outcomes we're achieving are very measured. And ratepayers will have certainty. But I also believe very strongly that not only do we need to look at the way local government is run, but it impacts the way we conduct our business and the way we interact with local government and with the federal government. And I think anybody who came to New South Wales and was told that we had 150 separate local government entities would deem that to be too many. And whilst I appreciate there may be some emotional sentiment in different parts of the state who are concerned, and I completely understand that, I back our plans 100%.
Mark. Just speak up a bit, Mark, into the...
Congratulations on both the presentation and on your performance both as the Transport Minister and as Treasurer. You spoke earlier in your speech about the desire for light-touch regulation. How do you reconcile your aspiration for light-touch regulation with the community's demand for government to be more involved in everyday life? You've got the challenge of lockout laws and other similar, relatively recent new interventions. But how do you reconcile those two, the demand from the community and the appropriate aspiration to have...
Yeah. Well, I believe very strongly in the principles which I mentioned about government is there to protect, to build and provide service. And community protection is key. So you have to ask yourself when posed with a question, is the decision I'm taking to protect the community more important than risking being regarded as intervening? And if the answer is the need to protect the community is the most overwhelming issue, well then you should do that. So that's how we reconcile, or I reconcile, that decision making. And the lines are blurred. It's not black and white. It's never black and white. What I've outlined to you tonight is the framework within which governments can operate, but there's no black and white formula, and there's always lines of grey. But principally speaking, I think governments are not demanding that we be more interventionist. I think people want to be able to exercise their choice. For example, if you say to a young person now, do you want me to negotiate with your boss on what your pay is? They'll say, no, I want to tell them myself. I don't know if any of you employ a lot of Gen Ys, but attitudes are really changing in the way people want to feel empowered. And I think as governments, we need to respond to that. So the question is, do you need to protect? Do you need to provide a service? Do you need to build? And then how do you make decisions around that? And there's no perfect answer, and there's no scenario where you can always predict what governments should do. But that's the overwhelming question. And I think protecting the community, providing services for the community, and building for the community are the three principles we need to always abide by. And that's how I reconcile it. Thank you for the question.
Just a final question. You've achieved a lot as Transport Minister and more recently as Treasurer. Are there any particular specific objectives you have in the short term, or is it just a matter of the grinding through... various budgets that have come?
There's lots to do, Jared, and I'll outline some of them in the next speech that I deliver at the Sydney Institute. But simply put, you want to make sure that New South Wales, I mean, we're lucky when we came, I shouldn't say lucky, we've worked hard at it. When we came to government, we were the worst performing state. We're now Australia's best performing state in terms of our fiscal strategy, in terms of our economy. And I don't think we should stop there. I think we should set our sights on being the best jurisdiction in the world. Our citizens in New South Wales deserve to have the best, in terms of quality services, the best infrastructure. And I think we shouldn't just aim for being best in Australia, but I think we should aim to be best in the world. And some of the things we're doing now in New South Wales are actually capturing the attention of other jurisdictions. And I have a few counterparts in other countries who are now wanting to talk to us about how we're doing things. So I think our aspiration should always be about improving the quality of life of our citizens and being best practice in everything that we do. Because that's what governments are here for.
Many thanks.
Thank you.
Well, we're very grateful that Gladys Berejiklian could spend an hour today this evening and take so many questions across a whole range of issues. Without question, the O'Farrell government and the Baird government has been a very impressive performing government, and the minister is playing a key role in both of those governments. Has been a very impressive performing minister, and we've seen an example of that here tonight. As the minister made clear, there's still more work to do, but a lot of work has been done. We're delighted that she's spoken for us now as treasurer. She spoke for us as minister for transport, and she's going to come back soon and speak again as treasurer in about a year's time. But for tonight, many thanks on a fine performance and well done. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.